Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about haircuts for veterans, the student climate strike, and how to build homes to protect them from wildfires. It's Friday, September 20th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Snow is anticipated across the higher elevations of south central Montana and northern Wyoming this weekend, which could impact the Beartooth Highway. The National Weather Service has a winter weather advisory in effect from this morning through Saturday morning in Madison and Gallatin counties, the Absaroka-Beartooth Mountains, and Yellowstone National Park for levels above 7,500 feet. Total snow accumulation of 5 to 10 inches are expected, with heavier snow falling on the highest peaks. Travelers on the Beartooth Highway should be prepared for rapidly changing weather conditions and possible closures, and backcountry activities could be impacted by heavy snow and low visibility. Yesterday, nonprofit Volunteers of America hosted an outreach event geared towards homeless veterans in Billings. As Kayla DeRoche reports, it drew a number of services, state agencies, and businesses.
Miriam Nosesgun owns a barbershop and crew agency called Cuts the Hair. On Thursday, she's in Billings, offering veterans free haircuts. 91-year-old Chuck Smith, who served at various times, including during the Vietnam War, comes up for a trim, and she fastens a sheet around his neck.
Can I take your glasses?
Sure.
Nosesgun has been offering free cuts at the Homeless Veterans Stand Down for the last 5 years, but the event itself has been going on for 9. Nonprofit organization Volunteers of America organizes it with the Montana VA healthcare system. Volunteers of America Director of Veteran Services, Bill Holder, says this event helps connect veterans with resources in the area.
Mainly so there's a central access point for veterans to receive services and just let them know that the community's out there. They're not forgotten.
Various agencies participated, including the Social Security Administration and organizations offering job assistance and housing guidance. Back at the pop-up barber shop, Nosesgun picks up her scissors for some fine detail and brushes the hair from Smith's shoulders.
Okay, looking pretty spiffy there.
She says it's been a slow day, but she'll be back next year.
Because there's just something about seeing them look at themselves in the mirror. You know they're feeling like so much better about themselves. It lifts their self-esteem. And they walk away and it makes me feel really good.
For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Electric bicycles are now allowed in Yellowstone, Grand Teton, and Glacier National Parks, along with the National Elk Refuge. Rachel Kramer reports.
The National Park Service recently announced a new policy that e-bikes, low-speed electric bicycles with power assistance, will be regulated as traditional bikes on non-motorized federal lands. That means visitors can use them on park roads, paved or hardened trails, areas designated for off-road motor vehicle use, and administrative roads where traditional bikes are allowed. They are not allowed in designated wilderness, in areas managed as wilderness, or on over-snow roads in the winter. Park Service Deputy Director P. Daniel Smith said in a news release that e-bikes make bicycle travel easier and they provide an option for people who want to ride a bicycle but might not otherwise do so. Outdoor and conservation groups have objected to allowing them in parks without additional study or public notice. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
More than 5,000 climate strikes led by kids are set to take place around the world today. Students, including some in Montana, plan on skipping school to protest inaction on climate change. Montana Public Radio's Maxine Spire reports.
In Missoula, high school and university students plan to walk out of class to draw attention to what they say is a climate crisis that needs to be addressed.
I think it's incredibly important for students in red states such as Montana to be standing up and vocalizing their need for action.
That's Maeve Lang, a junior at Sentinel High School in Missoula. She's one of the organizers behind Missoula Climate Strike. Another Missoula Climate Strike student organizer, Sarah Sriraman, says she's worried some of the student voices are getting drowned out by other activist groups.
And so it might be surprising, but this includes the liberal nonprofit environmental groups and so-called green businesses. And they really seem hell-bent on ignoring our request to stand behind us at this moment and not attempt to profit from what students have built.
Sriraman hopes the Missoula climate strike will highlight education about climate change rather than pushing any single agenda. And in that vein, the group has organized a series of talks, films, and discussions that are open to the public next week.
We're not educated enough to make demands of our politicians, of companies, of our school board. So we're taking this week to learn, as alternative education, things that we're not being taught about climate change, about capitalism, about how everything works.
Student protest organizers say education systems aren't doing enough to teach kids about climate change. Both the University of Montana and Missoula County Public Schools have said they'll accommodate students who plan on striking. UM professors can choose to excuse students who want to participate in events. MCPS says students must have parental permission in order to be excused. I'm Maxine Spire, Montana Public Radio.
A U.S. government watchdog agency that works for Congress says taxpayers could potentially face hundreds of millions of dollars in cleanup costs from abandoned oil and gas wells on public lands. I found out more. The Government Accountability Office said in a report Wednesday it identified almost 2,300 wells around the country that have not produced oil and gas since 2008 and have not been reclaimed. Frank Rusco is the Director of Natural Resources and Environment Issues at GAO.
Really the only thing that the Department of Interior has to use to plug and reclaim wells is the bond. And if the bond is inadequate, as it almost always is, then ultimately the federal government will have to pick up the cost.
The report says bankruptcies by well operators could cost the government between $46 million and $333 million in potential reclamation liabilities. The wide range reflects the unknown cost of cleaning up sites. Rusco says the bonds were
established 50, 60 years ago. Since then, technology's changed a great deal. Wells have gotten deeper and longer, and the bond rates haven't gone up. They haven't even been adjusted for inflation.
GAO recommended federal officials increase the amount of bonds companies must post before drilling. Current rules allow companies to post bonds of $150,000 to cover their wells nationwide. For YPR News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. The Environmental Protection Agency is rolling out an updated plan to protect Anaconda's creeks from copper smelter waste. But some locals this week said they're worried the federal government may back away from Montana's strict water quality standards for heavy metals. Montana Public Radio's Nora Sachs has more.
On Tuesday night at the Anaconda Senior Center, Charlie Coleman with the EPA unveiled the agency's latest plan for protecting Anaconda's creeks from historic smelter pollution.
If some of this sounds familiar, it is. We were here 2 years ago. We had a similar plan.
Coleman is EPA's longtime project manager for the massive Anaconda Smelter Superfund site. Almost a century of copper smelting here contaminated more than 200 square miles of soil and water with heavy metals and arsenic. Coleman says creeks and aquatic life in them suffer the most during spring snowmelt or heavy storms, when runoff picks up toxic sediments and carries them into waterways. Some streams in the area routinely fail to meet state water quality standards, especially for copper. He said Atlantic Richfield, the company on the hook for the cleanup, has already done a lot of work in the most contaminated lowland areas to control runoff and reduce erosion.
Even though based on that trend analysis, we see, you know, improvements to water quality based on the work we've done. The work that's remaining is in the steeper upland areas.
But EPA's models show that even with all the cleanup work slated for the hills around town, some creeks won't meet the state's stringent standards for heavy metals. So 2 years ago, EPA proposed changing the legally agreed to 1998 cleanup plan and called for replacing Montana's strict water pollution criteria with less stringent federal ones. That idea didn't go over well with locals.
The things we heard loud and clear were that you were uncomfortable providing upfront waivers to the standards until the work was completed.
Now, instead of replacing the state's water quality standards with less stringent ones right away, EPA will require Atlantic Richfield to first do what's considered to be the, quote, maximum remedy, unquote, on 36,000 acres. Since EPA determined that removing all of the widespread contamination is not a realistic option, The company will be required to revegetate hillsides, manage stormwater, and install features like check dams to control erosion and keep metal-laden sediments out of the creeks. If 6 years after this additional reclamation work is complete, monitoring shows that local creeks are still not meeting state standards, only then will EPA move to federal ones.
We're not proposing to waive standards across the board. We're only going to waive them where they're needed.
But locals push back on even the possibility of pulling back Montana standards sometime in the future. Butch Ryan is a retired pipe fitter from nearby Opportunity.
My complaint is to drop the state standards to go to the federal, to me, is a big mistake. The federal standards to me are not adequate.
Mike Eldridge from Anaconda worried that federal environmental protections could be subject to political whims and lowered.
If we're going to accept federal standards instead of state standards, what happens if the federal standards change, which could happen under different administrations?
About 50 people attended Tuesday's meeting. At least half were agency or Atlantic Richfield employees. While EPA's explicit goal was to discuss updates to the surface water cleanup and take public comment, many locals, like Mary Kay Eldridge, had other things on their mind.
Yes, I think that your plan shows what you want to do for the fish, but I think you should be starting out with helping the people.
Her sentiment was echoed by retired plumber Terry Galley. Last winter, he discovered black soot all over his mother-in-law's attic, which was presumed to have come from the smelter. He wondered how many other residents are still being exposed to historic pollution in their homes.
Now, this whole town is my family. They raised me. They didn't raise you, and they didn't raise any of these folks. They all came from somewhere else. But the people here, I'm going to care about. So I'm going to say something at meetings, like it or not, because I only care about what's going on in Anaconda. And if it's hurting our folks, we need to fix it. And if it's in our houses, we need to fix it.
The expansion of the residential attic cleanup program is one of many issues that are being addressed under Anaconda's pending Superfund cleanup deal, or consent decree. The changes EPA is proposing to make to the surface water remedy are also a pillar of that final deal, which lays out who does what and how it will all get paid for. But since EPA, the state, the county, and Atlantic Richfield are still negotiating the details of that cleanup deal, the parties are limited in what they can reveal. After the meeting, Anaconda's chief executive, Bill Everett, said he empathizes with the community's frustration at not being able to learn more.
As we go through this process, hopefully people understand that this will be the topic, and we're just going to try to knock it down to bite-sized chunks so people can get a pretty good appreciation of what we're trying to accomplish.
The public comment period on the EPA's updated plan to protect the Smelter City's creeks ends October 4th. The agency expects Anaconda's consent decree to be signed and lodged in a federal court this winter or spring. I'm Nora Sachs, Montana Public Radio.
The results of a plastic contamination survey of 50 waterways in Montana is expected next month. Kayla DeRoche went out with one of the researchers to learn more.
Sky Borden, director of Environment Montana, pulls up to a popular fishing access point along the Yellowstone River near Billings, with 80 large glass jars in the back of her car. It's her last day of gathering water samples, which she'll test for microplastic, small pieces of plastic that can come from things like clothing, plastic bags, and bottles. Borden carries a cardboard platter full of these jars to the rocky shore.
So this is going to be my 46th site to test.
The Missoula-based Environment Montana is a regional affiliate of Environment America, an organization that advocates for environment-friendly policies. Over the last 4 months, Borden has sampled rivers, streams, and lakes all across the state. She's trying to determine if plastic is in Montana's water bodies, and if it is, how much. Some of the plastic pollution is so small it's hard to see without a microscope. She wades into the water and ducks a glass jar beneath the surface.
We do try to get sample upstream because our clothes contain plastics. The muck boots I'm wearing contain plastics. The jeans that I'm wearing have a little bit of stretchy material in them that is plastic derivative. So in order to not contaminate the sample, I always sample upstream.
Borden says they found microscopic bits of plastic in more than 60% of the sites they sampled. She says some of that may be coming from cities like Seattle, when microscopic plastic evaporates and travels elsewhere via rain and snow.
But based on the amount of secondary plastic that we've found in the waterways, I think we could conclude that a pretty significant part is coming just from Montanans using the river, and then it's breaking down in our river ecosystems here.
In the second part of the survey, Borden goes around with a trash bag and collects whatever garbage she sees, like a granola bar wrapper.
This has a little recycling sign. Recycle always.
Borden believes most of the trash she finds is dropped accidentally. She says it takes a plastic bag 10 to 20 years to biodegrade and styrofoam 500 years. And she says it's unclear what microplastic pollution in freshwater could mean for human or animal health. The study of microplastics in freshwater and groundwater is new but has increased over the last 5 years. That's according to Todd Seib with the Missoula Valley Water Quality District. He's also surveying local water for microplastic pollution.
We're right at that stage of trying to find out if it's there, and then if it is there, is it a concern? I think other studies have shown that plastics can be a concern for wildlife, and we know that the chemicals that are in plastics and even the chemicals that are now being shown to absorb to plastics can be a concern. But some of those studies are really new. We don't know that answer for Montana and for Montana waters yet.
Borden with Environment Montana hopes these surveys and studies will help Montanans to learn more about keeping local water clean.
I think there is a need for us to all take individual accountability, but my hope is that we'll continue to think of broader systemic ways that we can tackle the pollution problem. And I think it does have to involve the corporations that are introducing the plastic into our lives in the first place.
She aims to release the final results of her 50-site survey next month. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Two trends are converging in large wildland states like Montana: more frequent and severe wildfires and rapid home development in wildfire-prone areas. Rachel Kramer reports on a conference this week examining how homes burn and how to protect them.
Kelly Pohl is with Headwaters Economics, a nonprofit organization based in Bozeman. The group hosted the Building for Wildfire Summit in Big Sky this week, along with the Big Sky Fire Department.
We know that wildfires are becoming more intense and larger and lasting longer in our state. And the data back this up. Wildfires have gotten bigger since the 1970s. The average acres burned per year is now about triple what it was a few decades ago.
According to the U.S. Forest Service, the wildfire season is also about 3 months longer due to a warming climate. In the last 20 years, the U.S. averaged $3.5 billion a year in insurance claims due to wildfire loss. It was $640 million a year during the 80s and 90s.
And the reason that we're seeing more loss and more destruction is because we are putting more and more homes in fire-prone landscapes. In fact, the wildland-urban interface is the fastest-growing land use type in the United States.
Poll says one in three homes in the U.S. are in the wildland-urban interface. That's where homes meet or intermingle with flammable vegetation, like a house built on the edge of a forest. In Montana, Poll says more than half of the homes built here are in those kind of fire-prone areas. She says Montana is ranked number one in the nation for the highest percentage of homes in areas with extreme risk to wildfires. Jack Cohen, a retired fire behavior research scientist with the U.S. Forest Service, says wildfires are inevitable, but the destruction of homes and the loss of human lives is not. He spent his career studying why some homes burn while others remain unscathed. Cohen shows a photo of Paradise, California, where 85 people lost their lives and 14,000 residences were destroyed by wildfire last year.
I was asked by numerous journalists, can you explain the unusual pattern of destruction of the homes surrounded by unconsumed canopies? And I would respond every time with, no, that's the typical pattern of destruction.
Cohen's research discovered embers from a wildfire, not the flames, are the main threat to homes. He found the characteristics of a home and its surroundings within 100 feet determine whether the structure will ignite.
Wildland urban fire disasters are a home ignition problem that can be solved by reducing home ignitability without necessarily controlling extreme wildfires. That's a big deal.
Daniel Gorm is with the Nonprofit Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. His team does experiments to find better ways to build homes that can withstand fire. Gorm shows a video from the research center where he works.
What we did here was create a duplex structure, and half of it we built with traditional building materials, and the other half of it we built with wildfire-resistant materials and construction techniques.
In the experiment, both units are showered with embers. The traditionally built home has mulch landscaping, cedar shingle siding, and open eaves. It takes less than a minute for the mulch to catch fire, and the cedar shingle siding goes up in flames. The unit right beside it, the one with rock landscaping, non-combustible siding, double-pane tempered glass windows, closed eaves, and 1/8-inch metal mesh over the vents, is totally fine.
Goes to show you that all of those individual components that we talk about, it's not just the roof, it's not just the eave, it's all of the components together.
The cost to build a wildfire-resistant home is comparable to one built with traditional materials, according to the institute where he works. Gorman says a fire-resistant roof is usually more expensive, but the siding is cheaper. Maintenance is also key to protecting a home. That means removing pine needles and other debris from the roof, gutters, and under the deck. Storing firewood away from the home and keeping outdoor furniture, brooms, and other flammable items inside. Even doormats can serve as kindling. In the 30 feet radius around the building, researchers say homeowners should remove dead plant material and shrubs under trees and prune branches overhanging the roof. All of these measures don't completely remove wildfire hazard, but they can mitigate it, especially if a whole community is working together. At the summit, fire experts from Jackson Hole, Wyoming and Vail, Colorado shared how they evaluate each property in their communities on fire resilience. In Teton County, homeowners are required to make changes to get up to code. In Vail, compliance is voluntary. Big Sky Deputy Fire Chief Dustin Tetrault says his department is working on education and outreach to encourage people to make their homes and businesses more fire resistant. But in the future, he'd like Big Sky to go further and have a system where properties receive hazard ratings. Resources for creating a fire-resistant home are on our website, ypradio.org. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds Monday morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.